I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Patty.
I just said after you read that, no pressure on her. Somebody better relate to her. I was sitting here thinking, the cool thing about sobriety is the friendships. And I got a text from Shauna at 8 o'clock. I was already dressed in my comfy clothes. I was getting ready to make some desserts for our home group cookout tomorrow. And she said, I'm speaking at 9, and it wasn't even a question. Okay, I'll change. I'll be right there. And there's a few other people in here. I don't know if they only got an hour notice, but there's a few other people that came. I live closer, though. That came from far away, because that's what we do for each other in sobriety. And I know that if it was the other way around and I would have texted her and she was home, she would have come too. And I just love that about what we have here. And you definitely are going to hear a story about alcoholism and, more importantly, recovery from alcoholism. And I'm very happy to introduce Shauna from the Buford Group.
Hey, everybody. My name is Shauna, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Shauna.
And I was so nervous, I didn't hear how long I was supposed to speak till.
10 o'clock.
10, all the way till 10 o'clock?
Right.
Okay. Didn't have enough readings for me to get my jitters down. Okay. So thank you, Jerry, for inviting me. And this is the second or third time that I've been out to this group, and I always enjoy it, so thank you for inviting me. And thank you to my friends for coming out and supporting me, because I was really nervous, so thank you. Even if you only got 1 hour for some of you. So I'll get started. My sobriety date is June 10th, 1995. I'll be celebrating 22 years next Friday at my home group, which is the Buford Group in Buford. We meet Tuesdays and Fridays at 8, so I got texted at 7:45 to see if I'd be discussion leader. I was like, no, I'm sorry, can't be discussion leader, so because I won't be there. But and I do have a sponsor, and I believe strongly in sponsorship. I believe that that's what we mean when we say to stay in the middle of the bed, that I'm sponsored and I sponsor others, and in that is where I receive the gift. I wouldn't be here today without the women that have walked me through these past 22 years. When I came in, I didn't plan on being here this long, so sometimes it blows me away when I start reflecting. And always this time of year, when I'm celebrating an anniversary, I start thinking about where I came from and what it was like. And it just blows me away, all of the blessings and all the miracles that have happened in the time that I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm going to share with you what I was like and what happened and what I'm like today. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with a group of women that came out of Biscayne that you are not to get up and say what it was like and what happened to it, because nobody cares about it. And she used bad language, though, but Jerry told me not to swear. So, and it took me a long time in sobriety to tell the difference between it and I. And as a matter of fact, I was speaking at Skyland, and I think I had like 8 or 9 years of sobriety when all of a sudden it occurred to me I was talking about it, and then I didn't have anything else to say. I just sat down, and that was the shortest talk ever, and everyone said it was amazing, so I have no idea. But it's interesting how we grow and how our perspectives change the longer that we're sober. So I'm going to try and talk about myself and not about everyone else. But I grew up in Denver, Colorado, and I am the oldest of 5, and I grew up with just one sister, and I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 13, when my mom got sober. So up until the time that I was 13, I was always afraid, and I didn't know why. We moved all the time. I was in 13 elementary schools by the time I was in 5th grade. And I've heard other speakers that are military. They were military kids that moved way more than that, and it just blows my mind because I thought 13 was a lot. And what I was like as a result of that was I just didn't know how to make friends and how to make connections and how to resolve conflicts, because this time next week I'm going to be somewhere else, so I'm just not going to deal with it. So I learned how to detach. And the therapist called that a dissociative disorder, but I thought it was helpful, to detach and not have to deal with things. So It's not good if you talk about yourself in third person at the therapist either, so don't do that. But so when my mom got sober, I didn't really know that alcohol was a problem, and I didn't know of what alcoholism was. But I knew that I didn't want to be like her to have what she had, so I set about trying to learn everything that I could. So I became the student of, you know, the Alateen and the Students Against Drunk Driving and peer counselor and all that stuff to try and learn as much as I could so that I could beat this thing, you know, and not be like her. I think if by the time you're 15 you have your favorite speaker in AA and you haven't started drinking yet, then you might have a problem. You know, so I was identifying with the problem. I was identifying with the thinking that this woman was having before she drank, and alcohol did for her what I needed something to do for me that I had never been able to find. And that was Irish Annie. She was out of California. She's since passed away, but I know her talks are still available. But I just thought, you know, well, maybe if I'd been raised in Ireland with my people, you know, it wouldn't be so bad. I would listen to her, you know, and she was very dramatic, or so I remember. Maybe if I listened to it now, it'd be totally different. But so when I took my first drink, I was 16. I was working at the A&W restaurant, and the older guys had beers. And they offered me one, and I said, sure. And I took it, and I put it in my purse. And they're just like, aren't you going to drink that? And I was like, oh, no, I'm going to drink it later. Because I didn't want to happen to me in front of them what happened to you. Because what happened to you when you drank was pretty spectacular. And so I was expecting something spectacular. And I'm the kid that when you spray the spray bubbles out of the can in the bathroom, like, I really thought they were going to zoom around and clean the bathroom, okay? Like, I was so gullible. I believed all that stuff. So I believed you when you said that you grew taller and bigger and curvier and every, you know, like, I really thought that was going to happen. So later, when I drank it and nothing happened, that was like, you know, a resentment that I had against AA that it didn't do for me. You know, nothing happened. Spectacular anyway. And so some time passed, and I got involved in high school, and I found that there are things that taste better than beer. The wine coolers became really popular, so I found I could drink quite a bit of those. And what I found out was that what alcohol did for me was it helped me to forget. And that's really what I wanted to happen. I didn't want to remember anything that had happened to me or that I had had to witness or to endure throughout my childhood. I just wanted to check out and forget, and that was the true way to detach or disassociate or whatever was to drink. And so my drinking started with how many wine coolers does it take to become an alcoholic? You know, if you're drunk after two, is that bad? Should I work it up to four? What if I'm up to six? And and my friends would always play drinking games, and I would always lose track and always be so drunk. And I was never, it was never enough, you know, and I just never remember being able to have just one. It was always in my mind, how many can I have and not be an alcoholic? And so I don't think that any of my other friends were thinking that same thing. But so what happened is, being a cheerleader and having gone to school with some of these kids, and my mom didn't move again, or didn't move me out of the same district again after she got sober. So these kids had known me for a little bit now, and a lot of the guys looked at me like a little sister and so sweet and looked so innocent. And so I went across the tracks to meet someone else who didn't care, you know. So probably one of you, met one of you across the tracks. And he really liked to party, drive fast cars, motorcycles, all that kind of stuff. And so we started drinking and partying a lot. And so then that began my one life that I was living by day at school as the varsity cheerleader, peer counselor. I was student of the year. And then at night, I'm running at these parties and riding on motorcycles and dirt bikes and drinking and doing all kind of other recreational stuff. And the two started to collide because I wasn't able to go to school. You know, I wouldn't want to get up. And my teachers were like, you're not going to be able to graduate. You're not going to get your credits. So I was like, well, how about if I just don't come in on Mondays? So my whole senior year, I didn't go to school on Mondays, and I made it the rest of the time. Mondays I would sleep, and the rest of the time I'd be running. And so that and that boy became my first husband, and I had my first child with him, and my son is 26, and I just can't believe that it's been that long ago when I think about it. It seems like yesterday. So during the time that I was pregnant, so first of all, I had to admit that I was pregnant, right? So kind of like you're already an alcoholic, but you haven't admitted that you're an alcoholic so that you could still drink. So it was like, well, I'm not going to admit that I'm pregnant because then I'll have to stop drinking because that would be bad. So I just pretended I didn't know. So I know some of you can relate to that kind of thinking. So I probably was a couple of months before I finally admitted that I was pregnant and I didn't drink. And I was able to not drink. And I have sponsored women who have not been able to stop. And I guess I was early enough in that I was able to stop, and I'm grateful for that. I was worried that there was going to be something wrong with him, and there probably is a lot wrong with him, but I don't think that he had alcohol syndrome. But so I didn't drink, and then I nursed him for a year, so I didn't drink that year. So you could imagine how much fun I was to hang out with. Untreated alcoholic, untreated Al-Anon, married to someone who's still partying and running around and doing whatever he wants to do. So when I first came in, my story was that the story that I told was that I ran to Georgia for my life for domestic violence, and I would have died if I had stayed there. And the truth, after doing inventory and many years of new perspective and rigorous honesty, that him and I, it was a mutual thing of violence, and I certainly contributed to it, and it certainly didn't have anything to do with why I moved to Georgia. But it got everybody to feel sorry for me, and that was always my big thing. Like, if you could feel sorry for me, pat me on the head, and then somebody would take care of me. I always found somebody to take care of me. I always had that one friend that would come and bail me out, be my driver, come get me wherever I was. And so I realized that I had been telling these lies to try and get attention and sympathy and, you know, somebody to caretake. And, some of it I didn't ask for, of course. I'm not going to take responsibility for his stuff. But certainly I contributed to that. And there's been times in my sobriety where I have tried to instigate fights to that same degree. And luckily I haven't done it with anyone who reciprocated or accepted my invitation to fight. But so when my son was a year, this part is like happened so fast this next year, because I started drinking at 16 and I got sober when I was 23. So, and I did not drink during a pregnancy and a year of nursing, so I didn't drink a lot. So when the book says that women can go downhill faster and some of us are beyond help after a short amount of time, I'm certainly one of those women that happened to. And that was my other resentment about alcoholism, you know, that I wanted to be able to drink like some of these other women that I had seen, women that got to drink a lot longer than I did and could control themselves and be responsible and do stuff, you know, and I just was not able to do that. And 6 months seemed to be my cycle of events. So I started drinking again, and of course, him and I had split up by this point, and I know you're shocked by that, right? And so we had split up, and so at the end of 6 months, through a series of events that happened, I ended up in a relapse prevention program. And in that relapse prevention program, I met a woman who was going to AA. And she was so much fun. She was blonde and blue-eyed and cute and happy. And I just don't really remember meeting anybody in AA that was as happy as she was. And she invited me to go to a meeting at her house, and I accepted. And that was the first meeting that I ever went to that I went to for myself that I can remember. I certainly had gone to a lot of meetings with my mom and that sort of thing, but not one that I really, that I said yes and that I wanted to go to. And so I went to the meeting at her house, and there I met my higher power, and he had 3 weeks and I had 1 week, and he had a Harley. And I can say that a Harley and relationship can keep you sober for a while. You know, it says in the book we're to find a sufficient substitute. And I can say that that was a sufficient substitute for about 6 months. Like, that's my deal. I can go 6 months on whatever it is that I'm using to treat alcoholism. And, you know, that poor guy, I don't know. Hopefully he's still sober today. But, you know, at the end of 6 months, I hear a lot of speakers talk about that they came in and they didn't get in the book or they didn't hear the message, and it wasn't until they came in and somebody came and walked them through the book that they were able to stay sober and it saved their life. And I thought a lot about my own sobriety in that time that I had in AA as a member there, and the real reason that I didn't stay sober. I mean, because I got involved in the fellowship, I was running with a crowd of people. I mean, you know, I was dating someone sober. I wasn't drinking. I had gotten a sponsor because everyone harassed me. I had gotten up to like the fifth step. I do remember that. And I remember, all I could remember was that it seemed that in the meetings, everyone talked about the shipwreck a lot. And I didn't know what the shipwreck was about because, of course, I hadn't read my book. And I was like, if they talk about the shipwreck one more time, I'm never coming back to this meeting, you know. But I've thought about that a lot, that what was it in me? And I wasn't ready to concede to myself that I was truly an alcoholic. And I didn't identify. And until I could identify with what alcohol did to you, I was still hanging on to what alcohol did for you. And I still believed that alcohol could work for me. It was the other stuff that I was doing that was the problem. It was the other stuff that I had hit bottom with. And so when I decided to drink again, it was what happened is this girl came in, and I'll never forget. She came into the clubhouse, and she announced that she'd smoked pot. And they were like, oh, you have to get a white chip. You are not sober. And it was a big uproar in the clubhouse. So she was like, well, if I have to get a white chip, then I'm going to go drink. And so she did. And she said, and I will be back on Monday or Sunday. No, she said, I will be back on Sunday. And I was impressed. I didn't know that you could do that. I didn't know that you could just go drink and come back. So I went. And you better believe that I was sitting in that chair on Sunday night watching the door waiting for her to come in. And by some miracle, she came in. She came back, and she was able to get her white chip, and everybody loved her and hugged her and welcomed her back. And well, that's what I saw. I don't know what they really did. And I still remember to this day that sense of relief. Thank God, because I need to drink really bad. And I'm going to go, and I'm going to come back. But I didn't tell anybody. I didn't make a big announcement to the clubhouse. I didn't tell my sponsor or my friends or even that guy. I just stopped talking to everybody. Disconnected my phone. That was always a good one. If you don't want people to find you, disconnect your phone. That, this dating myself, there's no cell phone back then. And so disconnect my phone. And I was like, I'm just going to go Tuesday night's ladies' night. So I'll just go and then I'll come back. I don't know when I was going to come back. Friday, I guess. So I went and I drank. And I remember being worried that the AA police was going to come find me. And, like, looking around, paranoid. And then I remember someone saying that they found crack on the floor at the bar. So the whole time I'm walking to the bar, looking at the floor. Like, I mean, I can't even imagine what I looked like that night. Totally paranoid, crazy. And I was having one beer. And that's what alcoholism looks like, you know, for me, untreated. So nobody came to find me. No search party was sent out. There was nobody waiting at my apartment, you know, or anything like that. And so I was kind of disappointed a little bit. But, you know, so Friday came, or whatever day it was later, when I decided that I was going to go back to the meeting. And I pulled up in the parking lot, and I pulled in, and I parked, and I couldn't get out of my car. And I watched people going in, and nobody saw me sitting in my car. I just kind of slid down in my seat, and I couldn't get up out of my car to go into the meeting. And so as soon as I saw that there wasn't anybody standing around, I pulled out and I left. And then the next time I tried to go to the meeting, I drove through and I didn't park. And then the next time that I tried to go to the meeting, I just drove by and I didn't pull in the parking lot. And then the next time I tried to go to the meeting, I just was like, why bother? I'm not going to make it. I'm never going to make it. That was my thing. I'm never going to make it anyway, so I'm just not going to go. And, you know, so when I think about people saying, you know, you can go and you can come and you can go and you can come. You know, not all of us make it back. You know, some of us, it's really hard. And it took me 2 years and moved to Georgia before I was able to make it back through the door. So I went and, you know, I started my thing. And I went and I was still, again, 6 months. And by the end of 6 months, I was doing everything that I had been doing before, plus some, add some. And I was facing a court trial that I had to testify in. My divorce was final. And I was so sick. I was so sick. And my aunt that lives in Georgia said that I could come out here for the summer to take care of her son, my cousin, that has cerebral palsy. And Clinton had just passed the FMLA thing. So I applied for it, and I was awarded a 3-month leave of absence from my job. And so I came to Georgia, and I didn't tell my aunt anything. I don't know about your families, but nobody in Colorado called Georgia to tell them what I was doing or even really what my court cases were about or anything. So all she knew was that I had gotten divorced, that I'd had some trouble, and come out for the summer, and it will help her out. It'll help me out. So I brought my son. He was 3 at the time, and we came out here for the summer, and I was so sick. I mean, I was detoxing off of so much stuff because, of course, every night we had a going away party. Like, I was going to be gone forever. It was only 3 months, but we had to have a going away party. But everyone couldn't go on one night, so we had to do it every night of the week. And so by the time I got here, I was so sick. And so I just told him, I don't know, I must have the flu or something. I'm like shaking, throwing up. It was terrible. And I was like that for like 2 weeks. I was like, oh, it must be the flu. And it was so hot here. It was so hot. I'm like, it's the heat. It's just, I can't handle it. And my poor aunt and uncle, they got the worst of me. They got my last year of drinking and my first year of sobriety. So I always, when they start getting on my nerves, I'm like, okay, I just remember what they put up with. They got the very worst. And so they deserve to have the best today that I can give them through Alcoholics Anonymous. But so I landed in Georgia. And I had this thought that I should probably call Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I got the yellow pages, or the white pages, making myself so old. White pages, and I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called, and Helen answers. And they have great meetings in Snellville, but for some reason she gave me the number to Serenity House in Buford. And back then they had a payphone on the wall at Serenity House. If you go there now, it's been gone a long time, but... So I called, and Bud answers. Bud, this is Bud. And I'm like, do you have AA meetings there? And so he told me all about all the meetings at Serenity House, and yes, they have meetings in Georgia, and yes, I could come, and here's the directions. But something amazing happened during that phone call. By the time I hung up, the thought had occurred to me that maybe I could drink in Georgia. Because I had never lived in a suburb before. And, I mean, talk about culture shock, coming from Georgia, Denver to Georgia, and Snellville, not even like Atlanta. And they play tennis, and they have decks, and they drink frozen drinks. And I was like, you know, maybe I could do this. So I cut all my hair off and bought the little outfits and sat on the deck with frozen drink and all that, and... So what happened is pretty soon they drink really slow, you know, and I'm like, you know, I'm already ready to have the next one. So then when I broke the blender, my aunt was like, I think you need to stop using my blender. So I had to buy her a new blender. So school is cheaper. Tuition was cheaper in Georgia than it was in Denver, even as a non-resident. So they talked me into staying and enrolling in college here. So I enrolled at what was then DeKalb College, and decided to stay. So I went back to Denver, packed up my stuff, resigned my job, and I moved out here permanently. And so I was going to school, and I was having to take vodka and orange juice to class in the morning, you know, and I was drinking vodka and Kool-Aid in my big plastic cup while I was driving with the kids so they wouldn't know. I kept tequila bottles under my seat so that I could take shots, you know, whenever I stopped anywhere. And that's what I would do just to keep from shaking and just, you know, keep myself together and feel like I could do everything that I needed to do. One of the things that I had done when I got off the plane when I first came to Georgia the very first time I prayed, I did say one prayer. I said, God, don't let me meet anybody that does drugs. Oh. You know, just don't, let's just not do that. I'm just going to drink. I'm only going to drink. So it was really funny. It wasn't until after I got sober that I met all kind of people that do them. But for that year that I was here, I didn't meet anybody. I mean, maybe pop it. That doesn't count, right? So, it was just alcohol. And within 6 months, which is my magic number, I was totally crazy and really sick and shaking in the morning and having to have the alcohol all the time. And I was really confused by that. And I'm like, but I'm not doing anything else. So I don't understand, because everything else was my problem and I'm just drinking. I shouldn't be having these issues, you know? It's not like I drink that much, I would tell myself. So I started doing things like forgetting my ID so then I couldn't drink, but I would get served anyway. Or I would be the designated driver, but then I would drink anyway, and then somebody else would have to drive. Or I would just leave my car and go home with whoever was there to drive. And I started, you know, changing what I was drinking, and, you know, just like it says, we try all these different things. Tried drinking with different people. The guy that I was dating, he thought I drank too much. And so I would not drink when I went out with him, but then I had to have another boyfriend so that I could drink with him. And so now I'm back to having this life over here and this life over here. And then I'm the nanny for my aunt and I'm the college student, and it just started to get really crazy. And, so I decided that maybe, you know, I needed to stop drinking. And so I was going to do it myself. So what I did was I started writing in a journal, and I would write in the journal, I'm not going to drink today, this is my sobriety day, blah, 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 blah. By the time I got done writing, I was saying something about, and there's a party on Saturday. I mean, I couldn't even, like, in my writing stay sober, you know? And I would go, like, I could make it, like, 2 weeks, and then I would be drinking again. And usually I would already be drunk before I became aware that I had even started drinking. Because I always went with the intention not to drink. And I would tell everybody, I'm not going to drink. And they would just roll their eyes. And next thing you know, I'm drunk going, but wait a minute, I wasn't going to drink. How did this happen? And they're like, well, you drink. So I don't know what happened the day that I decided to call that number again. I'd had a really rough time trying to stop drinking myself. I'd gotten to the end of my efforts of not drinking. And I was really scared. When it says cunning, baffling, and powerful, I mean, I was really scared that I couldn't stop drinking, and I didn't know what that meant. I couldn't really remember what you guys had said about that before, but I didn't have a conscious thought that I was going to go to a meeting. I just remember, like, getting up and going and getting that number getting the book off the shelf, taking the number out of the book, and calling the Serenity House. And can you believe that Bud was still standing there? And Bud answered the phone a year later. And I'm like, are you still having meetings there? And he's like, yes. And this time I didn't hesitate. I got right in my car and I drove over. He said, just drive over now. You'll be here in time for the meeting. And that was the first meeting that I went to in Georgia, was that noon meeting. And I remember walking in and just feeling comfortable, feeling at ease, just feeling excited that I was able to get through the door. Because remember, in Denver, I couldn't even get out of my car. So here I am. I show up. I go to the meeting. And I went a couple days in a row. And then and I was just so excited. So I was going over to my girlfriend's house. So I had a plan. This is my newcomer plan. So if you're a newcomer, tell your plan to somebody before you do it. Okay? So I didn't tell anybody my plan. And I went to my girlfriend's, and I took a soda with me, and so then I wouldn't drink alcohol because I'd be holding the Coke, right? But I usually talk like this and everything, and so I'm telling this guy, her boyfriend, who happens to be court-ordered to AA, all about AA and how much I love going after my three meetings that I've been to. And the flaw in my plan is that I didn't have two Cokes. So I had one free hand, and she gave me some tequila, and I just drank it. And I never missed a beat in my story. And he was like, damn, you might be one of us. And I was like, what do you mean one of us, you know? And then I felt it, and I was horrified because I didn't even know. I wasn't even aware that I had done it. I just did it. And, you know, if it was there, I was going to do it. And, you know, and I was just so devastated. Like, my whole pink cloud thing was gone. I'm never going to make it. I can't believe I did that. And, you know, I might as well get really good and drunk now, you know. And so I just started drinking really bad. And we were sitting there, and at some point in the evening, he hands me a joint, and he says, well, at least we're on the road to recovery. And it hit me, you know, like, in my heart, like, because I really wanted to be sober. And something in the way that he said that, I was just like, no, I'm not going to stay here with you. I'm not going to do this, you know. And I was just, I remember looking at the clock, and I'm like, God, if you can get me out of this, I will never drink again. And I'm not someone that prayed a lot of Hail Marys, God, get me out of this, you know. I usually was like, you know, figure it out tomorrow kind of person, you know, or this time next week I'll be somewhere else. But I did, and I remember I came down like I was coming down an elevator, and when I got to a floor that I could drive on, I picked up my keys and walked out, and I haven't had a drink since then. And when I went back to the meeting, I went to Oak Road, and there was an older couple there that was just so nice to me. They were so good to me that summer, my first, like, 90 days. They would come and get me. They would buy me coffee. They would sit with me in the meeting. They were just so kind to me. And they told me that I needed to have a book, that I needed to write my name, and I needed to write my sobriety date in it. And I was like, then I'll have to get a new book. You know, like, I don't want to write in it. And they were like, no, that's what you have to do. That's how you're going to keep your sobriety date. It's going to mean something to you if you write your name in your book and you write your sobriety date. So this isn't my first book, but I wrote down, and then I was like, well, I don't know what my sobriety date is. We're going to have to figure out, like, so I'm like, what is today? And we're, like, counting back, you know, and they've got their little calendar out of their checkbook, and we're going back, and they said June 10th. And I was like, okay, so I write it down, and they just looked at me. And now I have absolutely no idea what June 10th means to Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? Never do I remember my mom going to any of the internationals or talking about AA's anniversary or anything like that. And so I had no idea. And so I had about 60 days or 80 days, and I had gone to see my mom in California and came back, and everyone was like, oh, did you go to the international? And I was like, what's the international? And that's when I found out. And I found out that it was literally in my mom's backyard, and we didn't know anything about it. So that was another reason I had to write down, because I missed that one. I would have been at San Diego if I had known about it with only like 45 days sober. But I remember going to my first Atlanta Roundup. I had 30 days. Back then they were in July. And Polly was speaking, and she talked about alcoholism, the chains of alcoholism being too soft to be felt until they're too strong to be broken. And I remember sitting there and thinking, that is just what happened to me. That is exactly what happened to me with my drinking. Like, I felt like I could stop if I wanted to. I didn't want to, but by the time I wanted to, I couldn't. And there wasn't anything that I could do. And the first time that I identified as an alcoholic, I was sitting outside at the Oak Road group, and all the smokers would sit outside, so I became a smoker so I could sit outside. And so I sat out there, and somebody read from We Agnostics, and they read the description about what you might be an alcoholic if you don't have control over how much you're going to drink once you drink, or if you're going to drink or not. And it just blew my mind. I'm like, where has that been? I don't remember ever hearing that before. And but that was true for me. That was my story. I don't know. Maybe I'll have one, and I'll be fine. But maybe I'll have one, and it's going to be a total disaster, and they're going to be carrying me out at 3 in the morning, throwing up in the lobby at Applebee's. That was embarrassing. That happened. And so I was really, you know, I didn't know what to do. I was living with my aunt and uncle. I needed to go to meetings. I had my son. And so what happened is I got invited to a women's step study with a group of very strict women. And they used to call them the Nazi group. But Yes. Joetta's confirming, yes, they did. So they were very strict. They told you when to stand, when to sit. You do not get up once the meeting starts. If you have to go to the bathroom, you should have gone beforehand. And if you wanted coffee, you should have got it before the meeting started. And you are never to be late, and you are to dress appropriately, and blah, 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 and all that. But I needed that structure. I needed to be told what to do and where to go, because I was just so afraid. I was just so afraid that I was going to drink again, and I needed that structure, the guidance. So I had that on one hand. But then on the other hand, Helen had sent me to Serenity House of Buford, and I don't know if any of you have been to the Serenity House of Buford, but the group, the primary group at that time was the For the Fun of It group, and they are really in it for the fun of it. And they have a lot of fun, and they are relaxed, and there is no dress code, and people come and go, and you back then you lay on couches everywhere. They'd even turn the lights off and light candles and have weird meetings. And so I could, like, totally relax and chill out and kind of, you know, get that vibe up there, but I could come down and be get the structure and discipline that I needed from the women's study. And I feel like that really was what jump-started my sobriety. And then I was afraid to get a sponsor. And one of those women in the meeting, she just sat next to me and she said, "Baby girl, you're just going to come walk with me." You know, she didn't make me ask her or anything like that. She said, "You're just going to come walk with me." And she was my sponsor for 5 years. And she helped me so much, through so much. And she never felt sorry for me. Being a single mom, 23, three-year-old that I was having to drag around to meetings, she was like, "I didn't even have a car." She's like, "I was all that, and I didn't have a driver's license. So, you know, figure it out." I figured it out. And I found meetings where there was childcare, and I found people that I could swap with. It took him to a lot of open meetings. My home group, I became Progress Not Perfection, which was a young people's meeting at the time, and that was an open meeting. So he would come and he would sit under my chair and color, and nobody would even know he was under there until someone swore, and then he'd say, "Uh-oh," you know, and everybody would be like, forget that Jeremy was there. So a lot of old timers that know me remember me. "Oh, aren't you the one with the little redhead?" I'm like, "Yeah, he's like this now. He's got two children of his own." But he grew up with me in AA, and he has two children of his own, so I have two grandchildren. They're just beautiful, and he's been writing his story since he was 19, so I just keep praying for him and keep doing the deal, and I'm involved with service work and sponsorship and AA as a whole, because I wanted to be here for all of our children that might be still writing their story, and he's definitely one of them. He knows where to go. He just don't want to. He's a little rebellious. Like, he might have got that from me. He's a little rebellious, so we'll see. I know that God has a plan for him, just like God did for me. And at about 9 years sober, I started going to Al-Anon. And I would say that Al-Anon really saved my sanity going through his teenage years and seeing him off and letting him go, and also ended a second marriage. And Al-Anon just really helped me with my sanity as well as AA helping me with my sobriety. I just feel like the programs go hand in hand. They're not the same program. They're two different things that we do walking side by side in cooperation with each other. And the other thing that I got involved with in sobriety was Gikipaw. When my son left, a whole bunch of young men came and got sober in my home group in Buford. And they were really super excited about the Georgia Conference for Young People in AA. And I was like, you know, this would be something that I could do. I could support them and be involved in that. And it really helped my heart in letting go of my son that had just left home to kind of, I don't know, they kind of let me be the team mom kind of thing, if you'll say, being a little bit older. But you can be of service on that committee until as long as you're elected before your 40th birthday. So I was not 40 yet. So I got elected, and I served 5 years on that council, and I just loved those kids. And watching those young men and women get sober and stay sober renewed my faith and love for Alcoholics Anonymous, in seeing the message carried and seeing that it's still vital and is still here for young people, you know. And that meant a lot to me, so I just always like to give a little plug for them. What I'm like today has been quite a journey. I would say quite a transformation. I was so afraid for so long to do anything for myself, to make any decisions for myself. And there's the saying, not to decide is to decide. To not decide is to decide not to decide. And it loops and loops. And what would happen to me is I would literally be frozen with fear and not, you know, not do anything, not move from where I was. And so my journey in AA has been about the women in my life taking my hand and teaching me to put my hand into the hand of God as I understand him to be. And that was not an easy thing for me, because when I read the book and it said that we had to quit playing God, it didn't work. I read it like, well, we quit playing God and it didn't work, so I should resume playing God. This is why you should have someone go through the book with you. It's important. Stuff like that is important. Recently, I went through chapter 3 again, more about alcoholism, and the thinking, the alcoholic thinking, it blows my mind when I think about all the things that I've done or that I believed as a result of my alcoholism. And all Alcoholics Anonymous is about getting me to change my mind and getting me to trust in a power greater than myself that could resolve my problem, solve my problem, so that I never have to drink again. And I don't have to be afraid that I'm going to drink again. And I don't know where I missed that in translation. I think I was so afraid, I was just white-knuckling it for so long and still trying to do things my own way, still trying to arrange the show and set the stage. If I only had a husband, if I only had a house, if I only had a fence, if I only had a dog, if I only had all these things, all my circumstances, all my ducks in a row, then I could breathe again. You know that deep breath that I took when I took that drink? Always chasing that sense of ease and comfort. Never actually getting the ease and comfort, but being exhausted in the chasing it, being defeated in the not achieving it, thinking always that if I could find what was wrong in me, that I could fix it, then everything's going to be okay. And what I have found is that there isn't anything wrong in here other than my understanding that God is within me. And as long as I take the time to pray and to meditate and to reflect on that, to remember my identification as an alcoholic, if I remember that I'm still treating a disease that I still have today, that I'm not cured of alcoholism, I can have that freedom. I can have that ease and comfort today and every day, so long as I choose to do those things. And there are some days that I forget, some days that I doubt, some days that I think, you know, maybe I misunderstood. And that's when I'm just getting, you know, it's kind of like, I watch my younger kids, and they want to run, and they want to be free, but they want to run every so often. They just want to run by and touch me and make sure that I'm there, you know? And I feel like sometimes I do that with God, you know? I'm just running and running and doing my thing, and then I'll run back and, like, touch home base. Like, oh, I'm good. I'm safe. I'm okay. And then run off and do my thing, but I don't ever have to leave home base, you know? I don't have to operate like that anymore and get caught up in the insanity of my thinking and thinking that I'm never going to make it. It's never going to get better than this. You know, I would always use words like never and always, and things were never going to get better. I used the around the year with Emmett Fox that I was given by that group of ladies I told you about. Some of our founders like to use that book, so we had to use it. And one of the things in there, it talks about on the very first one, if you happen to get the book, January 1st, it talks about that God has the power to pick me up from where I am and put me in my right place. And I didn't ever believe that I had a right place, you know? I never really felt like I belonged or that I fit in or that I was accepted, that I would just have to pretend. I would just say whatever you guys needed me to say so that I could stay here and not drink. And I feel like that God has picked me up and put me in my right place here within Alcoholics Anonymous, within a community and fellowship of men and women that really love and care about me a lot, you know, and not based on what job I have or how well my kids perform or how well, you know, my marriage is or who I'm married to or what kind of house I live in. Y'all don't care about any of that. What you care about is my inner condition, and am I sober today? And what am I doing today for my sobriety, and what am I doing to help somebody else? You know, I really feel like that is my right place, and if I hold on to that, then anytime any of those other things start to get a little rocky or shaky, I just remember, it's a perfect world. That's what my sponsor says all the time. She's like, it's a perfect world. Everything is as it should be. So what's perfect about this, you know? And that helps me to let go of the fear and be okay with where I'm at and what's going on. And my life is so good today. If you'd asked me then, you know, they always say, make a list of what you want, you'll sell yourself short kind of thing, you know? And what I have, the life that I have today is beyond anything that I would have ever given to myself. You know, I wouldn't have thought that I deserved to have the life that I have today. And, you know, I feel really fortunate to be, to have the life that I have today. And not because of stuff that I have, but because of my place, of being, that sense of being in my right place. And I would wish that for everybody, to be in their right place. I don't know if I'm going to be able to talk all the way to 10, but I did have one last thing to talk about that I always close with, because it goes with my God story. So I love this book called Blue Like Jazz, not conference approved, so plug your ears. But so that goes to show you how far from those, you know, super strict whip-wielding women I am, because I'm going to tell you this quote. So in Blue Like Jazz is written by Donald Miller, and he talks about that he never liked jazz music because it doesn't resolve and it doesn't really have an ending and it annoys him, right? And he's like, I don't like it. And then one day he stood outside of a theater and he watched a man play the saxophone. And I don't know if you've ever gotten to do that, but growing up in Denver, I would often take the bus downtown with one of my girlfriends and we'd wander 16th Street Mall, and there was this guy that would always be on the corner playing the clarinet, and he'd just be going to town on that thing and his eyes closed and just playing and playing and playing, and I just would be mesmerized watching him. So when I read this, I knew immediately that feeling of awe and beauty that this guy was writing about. And he said that after that he liked jazz music, and he said that sometimes you have to watch somebody love something before you can love it yourself. It is if they are showing you the way. And I know that you guys have done that for me with the relationship with my higher power, that you guys didn't love me till I could love myself. You loved yourself, and you loved the God of your understanding showing me the way that I could do that for myself. And he said that often he didn't like God because God didn't resolve, but that was before any of this happened. So I would have to say that I didn't like God either. I didn't like God until all this happened. You know, I'm not somebody that would have wanted to sit down and have a spiritual conversation with you, you know, unless it was to maybe lead you to Jesus. And, you know, I could do that. I could get to the right verse, and I could do that, and I could pray with you. But the inside job, the true house cleaning, the true watching someone love something like that started here in Alcoholics Anonymous for me. And for that, I'm really grateful. So, and that's it. Thank you.